At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive.
All right. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm excited today to be with Kara Seidman, who is the Director of Partnerships with ResBiotic. And we met in the microbiome space. And as we were talking recently, we talked about how our team is working a lot on hormones and perimenopause. And it came up that we should really discuss what the microbiome looks like in this time of our lives as women. And so I'm really excited to dive into that with you today. So if you want to just share a little bit about yourself and your background with the audience to get started.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. So I'm a registered dietitian by trade, and many years ago, I'm not going to say my age, although this is a very pertinent conversation we're having as I'm getting close to that time of life, but came through very conventionally in the dietetic space. I was always so into natural medicine and diet and got into fermentation really early on, even before, I always say it was, this was before the Human Microbiome Project even kicked off, and found myself working in various demographics from diabetes to metabolic health, and then landed in gastroenterology care and started an integrative functional nutrition program within an allopathic conventional GI group. So it was an interesting relationship, but worked beautifully because I used to tell the doctors, like, the GI tract, but I really work within, and people would get screened. You know, I knew that we weren't dealing with certain structural or obviously conditions that are affecting the GI tract. And then there was a lot of working room we had. So it was a great relationship, took a lot of education. I don't think they really understood all that we did in this integrative functional space, but got to work with lots of patients, and I was with them for almost 9 years. So
that's awesome. Your brain sometime on that, like, how do we pair our clinical pharmacist team with those GI providers? Because you're right, like, so much of what they're trained from a conventional standpoint is to make sure there's not significant disease and structural abnormalities, and SIBO information is growing, and there's medications now to address some of that overgrowth. I feel like even some of the GI people are still not on board with that either.
And I think that always bugged me a little bit, because it's not a matter of do these things exist, or it's a different science and medicine. Yeah. I mean, I think I hear people say this, but we're going to have microbiome doctors. And I think that's really what we're leading down to, is the GI tract and the microbiome being really two separate entities. And we do have to look at it. And that's how I expressed that to the providers that I worked with, was there are things we can't see structurally, biochemically, things are fine. But we now know that, say, something like irritable bowel syndrome is a disorder of gut-brain interaction. And so we have enough research to back that up. And it always bugged me when providers would say, oh, this isn't real, or this doesn't exist. Sure. There's a lot of research. It's just not something that you can diagnose when you're scoping them.
Yeah. And thank goodness for Cedars-Sinai and all the work they're doing in that space and helping it come to true GI practice. Oh, awesome. Okay. As we dive into perimenopause, what do you, when we're starting out having a conversation, like, obviously we know that patients' estrogen is declining, that normally, or progesterone even so first, which then leads to this estrogen dominance effect. Sometimes people are getting really heavy bleeding cycles. Their cycles are really long, or their period bleeding is really long. Some people come in and they're bleeding for 2 weeks. I'm like, oh my goodness, no wonder you're iron deficient and tired.
That was my mother.
Yes. And then they end up going, just get a hysterectomy, and thinking that's going to obviously fix the bleeding problem, but it doesn't necessarily fix the hormonal imbalance problem. Maybe makes it worse depending on what all they took out. But so what is going on when we talk about the microbiome, when we see those fluctuating changes with estrogen and progesterone?
Yeah, I think it's obviously the research is still so young, and it's, I forget, I should have looked up this stat before we started, the amount of research that's being put towards women specifically, and menopause is far fewer than anything else, unfortunately. But with all this microbiome research, and microbiome research is just totally blowing up, expanding incredibly over the last 10, 20 years, we now have a better understanding of the relationship between these declining hormone levels and how it impacts our microbiome. And really, just to back it up, we have better understanding now of the microbiome and its role in really all diseases. I don't think there's any chronic disease that's not linked back to the microbiome. And it's because there exists these bi-directional relationships. I work for a company, ResBiotic. It's a term that we've coined as the gut-X axis, to really explain and to give this understanding of the gut's relationship and role to other bodily organ systems. And we know the gut communicates to just about every system and vice versa. And so the same is true for our hormones. We call it the gut hormone axis, or we'll talk a little bit more about the estrobilome. But just as you said, as our hormones begin to decline, we start to see that similar decline in our microbiome diversity and the overall health of the microbiome. And so this is a natural process that goes on. And we know that diversity and your intestinal barrier and the strength of your barrier, the production of really important compounds like short-chain fatty acids, that these are all necessary to have a very resilient microbiome. So we're naturally faced with this period of time where we start to see a decline in all of that. And so it's important, and I think as we'll continue to talk on, is that there are ways to support the microbiome to build resiliency, to help decrease any resiliency coming into this phase of life. And I think that's where perimenopause is so important, because as we read and know about perimenopause and experience as women's, it's like reverse puberty, right? And it's that natural roller coaster. I look at those graphs of hormone levels basically going like that. And I think we feel that, right? That's exactly how we feel. And so we see a lot of those sort of shifts that can take place in the microbiome. So I think there's a lot we can do leading up to menopause to really support the resiliency coming into this phase of life.
Yeah. So when we talk about what's happening in the microbiome, like talk a little bit about like the metabolic changes that are happening in someone in this phase of life. Like, you know, from my perspective, I saw a lot of patients with diabetes, a lot of people like diagnose with diabetes during perimenopause, because all of a sudden as the estrogen on that way to menopause is declining, estrogen plays a big role in helping to stabilize blood sugars. So they had all these other things that were also like not great for their blood sugars going on in the microbiome. But then as the estrogen declines, it was like, oh, that's too much. Now we're in balance or out of balance. So what's happening in the gut microbiome with like metabolic function and like diversity that we can try to address early on so that we don't get into this weight gain and blood sugar challenges later on?
So there's a few different things. And I think we take a step back, and obviously we understand this very much, but estrogen is protective, right? There's a lot of really important roles that estrogen plays in the body, from our immune system to our metabolic health. So when we start to lose that estrogen, that's why we're faced bone protection. And so we're faced with this period of life where we're at a much greater increased risk of chronic disease, osteoporosis, autoimmunity, immune disruptions, things like that. But the microbiome also plays a role in chronic disease development. So as our diversity, right, diversity being not just the quantity, but really the quality of your species, do you have those beneficial bacteria there that are breaking down, consuming the foods that we're taking in, breaking down those complex fibers to produce these very important compounds, short chain fatty acids, right, butyrate, acetate, propionate, to really provide benefits to the brain, to the heart, to the lungs, to all systems of the body in reducing inflammation and improving immune responses. So as we start to lose the beneficial bacteria, we start to lose the production of short-chain fatty acids. We start to create environments that's more friendly to our pathogenic or opportunistic bacteria. We'll get into this, I'm sure, and we can talk about it now, but bacteria that contain more lipopolysaccharides, which are endotoxins. So these are contained on the outer cell membrane of our gram-negative bacteria, that if you start to lose diversity, we start to break down that protective barrier. I think of it as my fence, that gut barrier, that mucosal barrier. And now pathogenic bacteria or toxins, inflammatory compounds can now get translocated through that barrier that's now not so supported and get into systemic circulation. And that is a driver for low-grade chronic inflammation. And that is really something that's been studied, that we see precipitating blood sugar changes and even obesity and weight changes. So it's not just this loss of diversity, it's this whole cascade that occurs where we start to see translocation of these more toxic compounds that really start to wreak havoc, driving inflammation, driving this immune dysfunction to take place. And that's really what starts to create this metabolic consortium and this change in metabolic health throughout the body. So it's, I think, a multiple step, like this declining and this loss of estrogens, right? So that's why it's a bi-directional pathway. You start to lose production of estrogen and progesterone. You start to lose these protective factors. And so that puts your body at increase. But then we're also losing function in the microbiome that's also helping to prevent changes in our blood sugar or changes in our metabolic health.
Yeah. Exactly. I think the research is fascinating on even like the development of type 2 diabetes and this LPS induced inflammation that's happening even like in the pancreas. And That's obviously close to the gut, part of the digestive process, but not physically in what we would consider the GI tract. And yeah, so it's definitely an expanding field. And I think even conventional endocrinology is realizing that there is this connection between the microbiome. It's part of the egregious 11, which they talk about at the ADA and also the endocrinology societies. But from a medicine standpoint, right, they haven't found a compound that influences this that's marketed as a drug, right?
Well, exactly. I think that's the disconnect, right? That we have a lot of understanding of the microbiome, but that translation to drug therapy, I think that's where we're leading. We've got pharmaceutical companies that are creating live biotherapeutics. In fact, the founder of Resbiotic is really, that's what started. He's got research in the lung microbiome and found these strains that are specific to respiratory health, but that's a really long and expensive process. But I wanted to go back to this term metabolic endotoxemia, which is that translocation of LPS. And I love one of my favorite studies, it was a mouse study, but the American Diabetes Association did this back in 2007. So really at the start of kind of the human microbiome project and basically looking at, you know, the chicken or the egg, what comes first? Is it obesity that's triggering changes in the microbiome, or is it the microbiome that's triggering these changes to our metabolic health? And in fact, they found that LPS was that triggering factor. And I think that's pretty profound. And I think there's more conventional practitioners that are starting to be more open to this idea of the microbiome playing a role. But to your point, when it doesn't translate to drug therapy, that's where I think things get a little bit misconstrued, which is why it's important that we have practitioners that are knowledgeable and working in this area. But it does open up a lot of exciting doors as this research gets to become more robust and we start to understand it a little bit more.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what is the gut's role in breaking down estrogen. And as far as like this whole term of the estrobilome.
Yeah, one of my favorite terms.
Yes. I know, it's all so pretty, right? Like you think, oh, this is just this beautiful. I mean, we think estrogen in women are just like, oh, this is just this beautiful part. But so often this is a reason that people end up having this excess estrogen symptoms is because the gut is not doing its job in helping to break down the estrogen properly. So talk a little bit about that process.
Yeah, so I love this term estrobilome, estrogen microbiome, and we have the endobilome now. We're really learning a lot more. Our microbes do more than just break down food, help aid in digestion. We know that they're obviously playing a much larger role in overall health. And one of the areas that's actually really been exciting to discover is this estrobilome. So this group of bacteria that have this specific enzyme, beta-glucuronidase. And so essentially what happens, right, as we produce estrogen and we go through phase one detoxification in the liver, basically estrogen gets put into a form that's ready to be excreted. And so we hear lots of people talk about it gets packaged up and shipped through bile into the GI tract where we poop it out, which is why pooping is so important. It's really one of the most important things when it comes to detoxification, phase three. But what happens is as those deactivated or those deconjugated estrogens, they're put into an inactive form, get put into or get into the GI tract, this group of bacteria, the estrobilome, if it's out of balance, can basically reactivate those estrogens and put it back into circulation. Now, this is a process that happens, right? There's certain estrogens that are marked for excretions, there's estrogen that's going to naturally go back into circulation, but we're like a well-oiled machine. And when things are in balance, this is happening at appropriate rates and amounts. Now, when things are out of balance or we're dysbiotic, say we have more imbalance in our beneficial bacteria, because there are beneficial bacteria that have beta-glucuronidase activity, there are pathogens that have beta-glucuronidase activity. So when there's an imbalance in the estrobilome, then we potentially risk putting too much estrogen back into circulation. Or even in the case of menopause, where we're not producing estrogen anymore, there's a risk of not enough going back into circulation. So there's this really kind of fine tuning that occurs within the microbiome. And it goes back to how healthy and how resilient is your microbiome? Are we doing this process correctly?
Yes. And then there's the whole like phytoestrogen conversation of how, and I think like we go back and forth on soy is good, soy is bad, all of these things. Do you have thoughts on phytoestrogens and how those in this microbiome fit into dietary patterns?
So I agree with you. It's confusing. I think a lot of nutrition-related studies are lacking. And unfortunately, I remember I had a provider, one of the GI docs I worked with, he's like, nutrition's so fascinating, but the research is so bad. And there's a reason. It's hard to
I mean,
get
no one's
funding.
paying for that, the
Exactly.
research.
Exactly. No one's paying for the research to look at what's preventing a lot of the chronic disease. But with that being said, I think, and this is where I think the microbiome really offers a very exciting area because we know there's beneficial components to phytoestrogens. They have other flavonoids, other phytochemicals that are so protective against other chronic diseases. But if our microbiome isn't able to break these foods down and to create these compounds that are beneficial, then I think that's where things get a little wonky. And so that's where it's extremely individualized. If you are someone who has signs and symptoms testing that's pointing towards estrogen dominance, then we may have to adjust diet based on it. We may have to do other, and that's why it's such a personalized, individualized approach. I am someone who does consume soy. I think it's important. I definitely look for certain versions. I'm a huge lover of fermented soy products. I love miso and consume these things. Again, for my body, for my time, it's right. And I think that's where we have to really look at the individual. And we don't know. Should everyone be avoiding phytoestrogens? I don't think we can say that.
Yeah, and there's so much like heart data too
Exactly.
on heart health
Yeah.
related to phytoestrogens as well. So I also agree, like soy is great and I love soy lattes. So there's
We eat
that.
a lot of edamame beans in our family.
Yes, especially when they're fresh and from an organic farm. It's
Exactly.
great. Yes, they're very good. Okay, so let's move to talk about a little. I know we like aren't going to dive too deep into the vaginal microbiome, but I thought it was interesting when I was looking at this of estrogen decline can lead to some of the loss of the lactobacillus. So when we're talking the gut, diversity is king, but when we're
Yep.
talking about the vaginal tissue, we really only have a few like predominant species there. In comparison, obviously a few is relative, but the lactobacillus being a big one that helps keep yeast and other things like in check. So I find women in this perimenopausal, menopausal timeframe often have increased risk of yeast infections, but then also even recurrent UTIs is an issue. So there's a little bit of discussion of estrogen therapy, like increasing vaginal lactobacillus and maybe helping with some of those urogenital microbiome changes. But just curious on what you guys look at as far as the connection between the vaginal microbiome and the gut microbiome.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more coming out and about the vaginal microbiome. We have testing now that we can look at. Absolutely right. You know, diversity in the vaginal microbiome, we want low diversity. And there's, as you mentioned, key lactobacillus species that are there to keep a very acidic environment. But we also know that our gut bacteria can also impact and play a role in the vaginal microbiome, which is interesting. Again, it's close proximity. We talk about that too. Like, there's a lot of questions out there as far as how do these women's specific or vaginal microbiome specific probiotics work when you take them orally versus doing one
Mind
that's,
blowing. You're like, this gets
well,
my gut to my vagina. Okay, great.
and I've talked with the research of these really the main vaginal strains that are used, Crispatus and some of these other lactobacillus strains, Jensenii, and the researchers basically say, hey, they live in close proximity. And you know it not to get too deep into obviously the anatomy, but they're very close to one another and we're wiping and doing things, right? So there's a lot of like cross-pollination that occurs. And similar, and so that's essentially how these oral, because there's, I've heard a lot of even providers say, oh, if you take an oral vaginal probiotic, it's not going to work, but it does. And so I
Yeah.
think
There's
that's
also the
really,
translocation across
exactly. There's translocation.
membranes too. So that piece is
But
definitely part of how it's working.
100%, right? It's just they're all in the same
Yes.
area.
Yeah.
But the gut bacteria do affect our vaginal microbiome. We know that our gut microbiome is obviously this reservoir for pathogens that can cause disruption to the gut, to the vaginal microbiome. We see that with different state types of vaginal microbiomes, and we know that pathogens in the gut can play a role. We also know that when you have decreased microbiome resiliency or poor gut health, that just contributes to, as we mentioned, overall inflammation in the body, overall immune activation. And so the vagina is a system of the body. It's not excluded from that. And then because of the changing hormones, like the reduction in estrogen, that obviously affects and reduces the amount of food being provided to the lactobacillus strains. So obviously that's playing a role. So even if we're dealing with vaginal related issues, that you still have to take care of and think about the gut microbiome. And I've done vaginal microbiome tests. I often do them co-occurring with gut microbiome tests, because you can really then get a full understanding of the picture of how to not just add more of those specific lactobacillus strains, but actually improve the health of the gut microbiome so we have better crosstalk between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so fascinating how the hormonal shifts are impacting the transition of these bacteria. There was even a study, which we can link in the show notes, about menopause associated with an altered gene microbiome and estrobilome and implications for cardiovascular risk based on those changes. So it, in my mind, it's okay, we talk about estrogen and cardioprotection. Is the cardioprotection actually coming from the microbiome in maintaining some of that diversity and that relationship instead of just the estrogen impact on receptors itself? And it's likely probably multifactorial, right? It's probably not one particular thing. But this study was in Hispanic community and specifically in Latinos. So it's super, super interesting. I feel like we could just dive into the literature like all day long about this. But yeah, so as far as, are there specific interventions that you find to be helpful? Obviously, you guys have products geared towards this population, but talk to us about like, how do we keep the diversity? Because there's going to be women that choose to go to hormone therapy routes, which may help prevent some of these changes if we keep estrogen, progesterone on board. But if they're not a candidate for HRT or choose not to be an HRT user, what can we do to continue to support the microbiome to make sure that we have the diversity and help prevent those overgrowth of pathogens?
Yeah, I think that's what's so important when we're looking at all this research related not just to perimenopause and menopause or just other chronic conditions, is that we used to only think really about like genes and our genetic predisposition to things and the environment and our diet. But the microbiome is that kind of third leg of the stool now that is considered as part of that interventional path. And I think one of the compelling and exciting areas is that we can do a lot. There are a lot of interventions that we can prepare our bodies. So as we said, this is a shift that naturally happens, and you're going to naturally get that decline in your diversity and in your beneficial bacteria. So if we can preemptively build those things up or do a lot to support it, then I think we can enter into these transitional times with more resiliency. One of the interesting studies, since we were talking about research, that I thought just made me chuckle a little bit, is that when they looked at the microbiomes in, and we can link this study as well, in postmenopausal women, that the postmenopausal microbiomes actually look similar to the microbiome of a man. I know, we could go off on
when our estrogen is decreasing, then we're more like men.
We're more like men. And so I think there's a lot we could say there, but I think that's really fascinating. That's when we start to profile the microbiomes. And so there's some really interesting studies. But what's empowering is there is a lot we can do, and even very simple steps that we can take where it doesn't feel like I have to do all these things, I have to just eat a good diet or just this. But diet is truly one of the most important things, because we know that our diet plays such a key role in the health of our microbiome and overall health in general, but specifically to the microbiome. Higher intake of ultra processed foods, it's probably one of the biggest area of research now. The combination of these emulsifiers and preservatives, that there was actually a really interesting study that came out last year. Yeah, I think it was 2025. So this year, that looked at, they used to look at emulsifiers and preservatives individually and their impact, but they looked at the combination, which is how we typically consume these types of products, or how we typically consume these types of compounds. And that it was the combination of these that actually put us at a greater metabolic risk and increased risk of diabetes. So I think there's simple changes we can do in the diet and looking at how much of these ultra processed foods, how much fiber are we eating? There's a lot of talk going on about fiber. And as I hear from the social media folks, this fiber maxing and all these things. And I think it's not, maxing. I know, I think it's so funny, because as a dietitian, like, we've always talked about fiber. We never not talked about fiber. But it truly is the biggest modulator of the diet. So how can we start to slowly make some of these healthy swaps? How can we start to increase some of these fibrous foods, fruits and vegetables? We live in a society, I think, because we have 88% of Americans are metabolically unhealthy, that diet becomes such a focus. And we look at these very extreme diets, but we have to consume our carbohydrates. And when we do, we want to consume fruits and vegetables and whole grains and nuts and seeds and beans and legumes, because this is what's feeding your beneficial bacteria. I will say, we don't want to jump from having not much fiber to then consuming so much fiber, because you will probably feel bloated, and we have to build that tolerance. And and more importantly, we actually have to build up those beneficial bacteria that are needed to actually break those fibers down to produce these beneficial compounds. So I think those are some easy swips. How can we add some berries to our breakfast? Sprinkle some chia seeds. I'm super into basil seeds now.
Ooh.
Oh yeah, they've got like for 2 tablespoons, like 15 grams of fiber and
Wow.
but
Do they
super.
taste like basil or no?
No, but
Okay.
they do have a little bit of a taste. So I'll have it like, so for example, I'll have almond butter or peanut butter or some butter, whatever we have in our house, an apple as a snack, one of my favorites. Usually have to share it with my daughter, but I'll
Right.
sprinkle
Same.
the basil seeds on the peanut butter and mix it in. So it's like I'm dipping the apple and I'm getting this crunch with the nut butter and super good, but 2 tablespoons, just that's not that much. And you get 15 grams. So super cool.
Yeah.
And they're very similar to chia seeds. But how can we start to incorporate some of these things into what we're already eating that can
Right.
amplify the nutritional quality? And so I think diet's one of the biggest factors. And of course, diet's hard. There are foods we don't like. There are things that are missing. And then that's where we can really look to targeted and precision and high quality supplements to really help, again, amplify. I think there's only so much we can do with diet. We know that diet's going to feed your beneficial bacteria. I also think there's specific probiotics out there that are helpful in promoting that diversity and promoting your beneficial growth of bacteria. We've now got postbiotics that are really targeted to the gut and even postbiotics that are targeted to this estrobilome and making sure that we're having a proper fluctuation and support to that estrobilome, which is really cool. Prebiotics, I think, are always something that's so important to add into our intervention plan because even if we are consuming decent amounts of fiber, the majority of us are not getting the variety of fiber. I can definitely speak to that. Like, I eat the same beans or the same vegetables. I try so hard. I have like a chart on our refrigerator. So when I'm making my grocery list, I try to pick 3 different vegetables or 3 different fruits. So just to try to get some variety. But that's where prebiotic fibers are so important. I love resistant starch. At Resbiotic, we have a really cool prebiotic fiber. It's a resistant starch, which is digestively friendly because especially women who are entering into going through perimenopause into menopause, there's a lot more bloating. We see a lot more irritable bowel syndrome, and it's because of all this that we're talking about. So then we almost become fearful of adding in more fibers. So what's nice about some of the prebiotic fibers, and especially this resistant starch, is its dual action. So it helps with bloating, it helps with constipation and diarrhea because unfortunately, if you don't have a lot of the beneficial bacteria there and you're starting to give a lot of these prebiotic fibers, they can promote a little bit more bloating. And I love resistant starch. And I'm not someone who eats a ton of green bananas. I don't eat potatoes and then cool them off and
Right. Now, sometimes when I get the potatoes on the fridge, I'm like, oh, I should have a couple of these before I heat them, reheat them, right?
yes. And so it's just these things that you think about. And so that's where I think good quality precision prebiotics are so helpful. We have a product at Resbiotic called Res G Prebiot. Energy prebiotic, I love it because it adds beetroot extract, which is actually very important for women as we're going through menopause because we start to decrease and naturally decrease the amount of nitric oxide that we produce. And beets are so rich in natural nitrates to produce nitric oxide, which has profound benefits from cardiovascular health, endothelial health, to stamina, mitochondrial health. Also, wonderful polyphenols that support the growth of beneficial bacteria. So, really good. I use this as like a pre-workout. And then we add some methylated B12 in there. So, I love this prebiotic. I add it to like my drink concoction in the morning to give that boost. And it's again, you're getting a good amount of prebiotic fiber as that extra support in addition to what you're getting in the diet. Yeah. So I think from diet, also looking at the things that we know decrease resiliency or decrease diversity in the microbiome. So chronic stress, right? Everyone has stress. We live in a very stressful day and age. We've got kids, we've got life. It's not that we have to get rid of stress, it's how do we let stress impact us? How do we cope with stress? So I think that's something we really need to look at, especially as we go through this period of time. I think perimenopause as late 30s through our 40s is just naturally a very stressful period of time in women's lives. Our kids are at certain ages. And so I think it's so important that we focus on self-care, what's helping to reduce stress. Sleep is another thing. Poor sleep negatively impacts the microbiome. So how can we start to improve our sleep prior to this transitional period? Certain medications, antibiotics, proton pump inhibitors. These are all the sort of microbiome disruptors that are out there. And so I think about that and say, okay, as I'm getting close to this period of time in my life, what more do I need to do to cope with stress? Maybe I need to take 20 minutes every day and go for a walk outside. These are the things I think it's so important that we start to prioritize that in our life now, in addition to obviously all the other things that we know. But I think we're always looking to add in things, but what can we actually do in our life? Take out to improve upon that does have such significant impact on our microbiome.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of the foods that you were talking about are within that Mediterranean diet
Yes.
template. And there's a lot of research
Oh,
on
yeah.
looking at the Mediterranean diet interventions in postmenopausal women and finding reductions in weight, blood pressure, there are improvements in the omega-3 fatty acid ratios and lipids improvements. If people need a template to, and I think the nice thing about the Mediterranean process is you're not really like eliminating something. We're not
Just
telling
about to
you
say.
to, yeah, we're not telling you to get rid of this category of foods or this category of foods and go low carb or keto or, and while there is probably a lower carb approach necessary for some people with some metabolic health issues that already have disruptions in their metabolic health, at least this has been shown to be one of the most effective at increasing diversity in the microbiome, as well as improvements in those cardiovascular markers. So if you need a template, look for meta
And I just
template.
have to say, I think it's beautiful. You know, I've been in the diet and nutrition world for a long time now, and the Mediterranean diet's always been the diet that's looked at. But the key factor is they're promoting definitely a lot more plant-based food, but they don't eliminate any main macronutrient group. And I always talk to my clients still to this day and say, when we eat, we need to choose a food from your protein, from your carbs, from your fats. I don't believe we should. I'm always an advocate of consuming protein and carbs, especially when it comes to blood sugar regulation, but we're not really eliminating any one food group, and we're choosing the best versions within those food groups. And I think that's so important. So call it a Mediterranean diet, call it a balanced diet. And it's interesting now because there's a lot of obviously conversation regarding high protein and low carb. But the fact of the matter is, if you have a dysbiotic gut microbiome, meaning you have an imbalance, you have more pathogenic, unfriendly, opportunistic bacteria there, then all that protein that we're consuming, especially when we're consuming high protein diets, not all of it's getting broken down in the stomach, in the small intestine. So you have these larger protein molecules that are getting into your microbiome. And if you have more dysbiotic bacteria there, then they're producing compounds that are actually more harmful for our health. And so I think we have to take a step back from a lot of the diet noise and say, okay, here's the list of proteins that I like. What's the best version? Here are the carbohydrates I like. How can we make them more fiber filled? How can we choose more whole grains? How can we consume more of that complex carbohydrate and start to build our meals off of that idea?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think even our practice, we're recommending higher protein for a lot of women because we look at their dietary history for the day and they've had a chicken breast at dinner. That's like the only thing that they're eating. And so it's okay. You cannot, your energy and your metabolism cannot be fueled on just the chicken breast at dinner. So sometimes it's like getting them to eat protein throughout the day. But then on the other end, you've got people high dosing. I had a patient, this was a male patient recently, that was doing like milk all day and protein shakes and all of these things. And it's okay, that's probably, I realize he's an athlete, but it's like way too much on some aspects, especially when we talk about the microbiome and just milk in general with all of the excess hormone components and things like that in it too. So yeah, I
I
think
just, yeah, I want to add
balance.
though that it's balance. That's exactly it. The examples you're giving are people who are eating one food group at one point, right? And I look at, so I use a lot of analogies in cars, but I look at each meal as the time that you're fueling up, right? Like if you put gas in your car and don't have enough oil, you're not going to be able to drive where you want. So if all of a sudden you run out of gas and you only put oil in your car, you're not going to drive. And I think we look at the day as a whole, but we actually have to look at each meal as its own unique thing, because after about 4 hours, that's moving through the digestive tract. It's getting broken down. So if you only eat protein at breakfast and then lunch is only carbohydrates, you're not really driving your car as efficiently as you can. And that's the biggest thing that I see with my clients is just imbalance, like eating just protein or just carbohydrates or only certain meals a day. And that's, I think, the big factor is that you have to balance it out. It doesn't mean you need to eat a significant amount of protein at one meal over another. It's that you really want to incorporate the balance.
Yeah, and I think the balance is so important, just all of this that we're talking about, because like even some of these good microbes, when they get out of balance, like they're not necessarily good anymore, or commensal bacteria can become overgrown. And that's really the whole purpose of functional integrative medicine, is like finding balance in your physiology. And so many people see it as this out there thing, right? It's not research. And it's like, we're not like trying to do crazy high dose vitamins and nutrients. It's really all about How does your physiology work to its optimal? How do your mitochondria produce energy like they should? Because we're bombarded, like you said, with stress and toxins. And we even get into the fact that it's how much the toxins are influencing your microbiome. We talked a little bit about emulsifiers and things, but there's so much that our body's dealing with on a daily basis. I've probably said this before on the podcast, but I had a colleague once tell me that, like, your kidneys and liver, they do the detox. You don't need any support there. And it's okay, if we lived in a bubble in a perfect world, like, our kidneys and livers would absolutely do all the detox we need if all our food was clean and there was no pesticides and no microbiome changes that are influencing the liver function. And so we just live in an environment that is not favorable to our physiology. And so our bodies are in a way learning to adapt, but we also have the opportunity to utilize these tools to bring it back to the homeostasis and the balance that we need.
Yeah, it sounds a little doom and gloom, but we are our bodies were not made for this modern world.
Right.
But there are things we can absolutely do. And again, even just going back to the dietary changes, a lot of the microbiome studies look at just diet on the impact, and it has significant impact. And so I think it can get overwhelming. I look at all the things, I'm like, oh my goodness, like plastic, this and that. And I just take a step back and say, what is it that I can do? Because we live in this modern world. I don't live out in a jungle and in a tribe. And
even if we lived in a bubble, it would be a plastic bubble.
It would be a plastic bubble.
Those plastic things you can get in and run on, like, the pond or lake or something.
I know. And it's outside, so it's heating up, right? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So I do. I try to take a step back and just say, what can I do in my life that makes sense for me, where ultimately, and especially when it comes back to the microbiome, the things that we're doing from diet to these precision and targeted supplements to everything else, eliminating the things that we know impact it, it's just to build resiliency so that you can 80% of the time be on, but then 20% of the time, it's just not impacting us as much. And I think that's the key to this, is how do we build enough resiliency in our body that you go out to dinner and it doesn't throw. I would have patients that come to me and they're like, I ate this one thing and I've been set off for 3 weeks. That is not a resilient body. We live in modern world. There's some really cool things that have advanced from technology standpoints and even technology related to studying the microbiome. I'm thankful to that. But it's just, how do we look at the world that we live in and do the best we can that we know is supporting our body, so that the other 20% of the time we can enjoy and do and not think about it.
So to wrap up here, I think our message to people listening is support your microbiome with lots of diverse fibers. If you can't do that from just a dietary standpoint, there may be some prebiotics, resistant starches, supplemental things that we can add in to find that balance. And even things like cruciferous vegetables and phytonutrients can be found in versions of supplemental things as well, and fiber powders, but finding a way to create that resilience for your body. And then also making sure from a microbiome standpoint that if you are experiencing symptoms of whether it's menopause changes, perimenopause, or bloating and things, that you seek out a provider that can help you find balance in those symptoms and provide testing options. There's ways to look at your microbiome and sequence your microbiome, which is, when we think about 10 years ago, like, where we've come in microbiome world, and just being able to look and see what's there is huge. Yeah. And even to see, like, how estrogen is being supported in your microbiome or not supported, and the estrobilome component can even be looked at with testing. Such a huge area of research that's still ongoing, but I appreciate your time. And tell us a little bit about how people can find your products, and then whether they're a provider or a patient listening, how they can connect.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on. I think this is such a pertinent conversation, and we're learning more every day. And I think the empowering thing is, if you are a woman who's entering this period of time, that there's a lot you can do now, and there's things you can do when you're experiencing symptoms. That's the exciting area that we're excited to work in. There's targeted postbiotics, there's lots of herbs, there's blends, and I think there's lots of innovation happening that can be added as a support tool as we go through these natural transitions. So check us out at resbiotic.com. If you're a provider, we have an exclusive healthcare provider program where you can learn more about our science. We're, like I said earlier, focused on this gut-X axis, how the microbiome impacts other bodily systems. So we have a lung support probiotic. We have a GLP-1 postbiotic. So again, it's a heat inactivated or a heat treated probiotic, meaning it's like a zombie. It's in a ghost biotic state. So it's still beneficial. It retains some very targeted functions. And this one specifically supports the natural production of GLP-1, and it combines fenugreek and white mulberry. So again, getting those bioactives combined to it to really enhance the metabolic benefits, which can be super helpful, especially when we're at an increased risk of metabolic conditions. We have our prebiotic, and then we've got some really cool products coming down the pipeline that I think are super pertinent to what we're talking about. So it's exciting. Healthcare providers can get more of the research. We have an exclusive provider program. So head over to our website and you can see it there. Consumers, we also have a consumer side. So lots of education on our site. We're devoted to really putting science. That's one thing that I would say is super unique about what we're doing at ResBiotic is we're built on this sort of pharmaceutical level development where we do a lot of preclinical R&D work on not just our biotics that we're using, whether it's probiotics or postbiotics, but also the bioactives, the herbal and mineral blends that we're doing. We look individually at the impact that they're having, and then we look at everything as a finished product, and then we follow everything up with a human clinical trial. So that is exactly how we develop pharmaceuticals. Our founder is a medical doctor. He's been in the research space. He's been in pharmaceutical development. And for him, he wasn't a functional practitioner. And in his mind, it's if we're going to develop supplements, we're going to develop it with that same level of rigor. And I love that. I'm as an evidence-based
That's
practitioner
awesome.
myself, I think it's so cool. So come to our website. You can read more about that process. And we're here to support and answer any questions that anyone has.
Awesome. Thanks again for your time today. I appreciate you joining us. And if people are looking for a provider that can help them on this journey, you can also find us at farmtotable.life, and you'll be able to schedule a discovery call in the top right corner with a provider that is in your state. All right. Thanks, Kara.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.